your stories are safe here. What does that mean exactly, safe? In my work and personal brand and style, trust is serious business. So is confidentiality. I believe in honoring things like agency and choice and privacy. This show empowers guests by inviting them to speak freely and openly while protecting their personal details, if that helps make them feel safe. Now, this first season, aptly named the Tragic Optimist Tour, unfolds in parallel with the literal journey of a lifetime, a kind of personal and professional odyssey of my own. Against the backdrop of a tumultuous political climate that we find ourselves in, where our nation's most vulnerable people have been victimized, vilified, and outright erased, I made the decision to embark on an epic road trip in an attempt to process it all, make it make sense, learn more about the experiences that we share, to take it all in. What I discovered was equal parts beauty and terror, joy and pain. Truly the definition of tragic optimism. In a period of 30 days, I drove across 30 U.S. states and 2 Canadian provinces with the mission to connect with as many clients, collaborators, and community members as I could in celebration of my 5-year business anniversary, a milestone I thought I might never see. Some of the episodes in this season were recorded on that trip. Hey, weirdos and queerdos, in support of safety, please be advised that this podcast contains explicit language and direct or indirect references to material which some listeners may find triggering. Topics are highly personal and intimate, likely to touch on themes including but not limited to abuse, bigotry, body image, disability, mental health, sexuality, and trauma. Please prioritize your safety and the safety of those around you who may be exposed to this material, especially young folks. Please also note, this is an ongoing project, which means I am actively engaged in learning while creating. The format, the tools, and skills to produce this material are all new to me, even though I've been nurturing the idea for Attention Confidential for almost 3 years. As I build and refine, I ask that you understand there may be kinks along the way. And because transparency is one of my core values, I should also share that I am using software that includes enhanced features to simplify the editing and post-production process. Any editing of this content, however, this original, organic, human-generated content, is done so at my discretion, specifically to optimize sound quality, not to manipulate, omit, or alter any substantive material in the recordings. All guests have a chance to review the material before it is published so that they can be assured their voices and stories are held and shared with care, treated as sacred things to preserve and pass on. The original music, as featured on Attention Confidential, was written, composed, and produced by Christopher Colley Biondi, a deaf pianist, composer, and dear friend in Central Kentucky who generously provided his skills and talent to support the launch of this podcast.
Welcome to another episode of Attention Confidential, where we explore self-awareness, curiosity, and advocacy in a safe container. These three themes are expressed as mirror, magnifying glass, and megaphone, which you'll come to know the more you listen to this show. The other special thing about this program is that not every guest chooses to disclose their identity. Today's guest has decided to share with us who they are and what matters to them. I should tell you, they use they-them pronouns, they identify as queer, and one fun fact about them is that they love anything and everything with fur. Very, very grateful and honored to have Lenny here with me today. We're actually in the same space together, which is very special. Excited for you to be here and join us, Lenny. Would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself before we dive in?
I feel like there's a little bit of a caveat on the anything with fur because of, like, furry spiders. And, like, on the one hand, like, I don't kill spiders. I put them in the little bug taxi and I take them outside. But I don't think I would go petting a tarantula, but I would go petting a bear.
Totally with you on the spiders. And hairy spiders just makes them all the more creepy.
Right? Just like, you be over there, I'll be over here. Like, I'm in the house, you be outside, and we'll all be fine.
Bears, on the other hand,
they'd be really good huggers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And their little ears, like, unfair. My name is Lenny. I spell it with one N. When I chose my name, I wanted something that sounded masculine, but looked kind of feminine. And so that's why I took the N out. And Lenny is also a family name. I named myself after my grandfather because my dad was adopted. He lived with his mom, but his stepdad adopted him when he was like 18. It was one of those things where like my grandpa did not need to adopt my dad. He was not in a position where like he needed that. But like to do it at that age is really just for love. That choice of love is something that I want to remember and stick with. So that's why I named myself after my grandfather, but then made it just a little bit queer by taking out the N.
Thank you for telling us about the history of your name. I did not know that about you. Very cool. Anything else you want to share about yourself before we dive into the self-awareness piece today?
I discovered that I was queer pretty late in life. So I had a long time of being unhappy and being closeted and masked. It's been a journey for sure.
You're a parent?
I am a parent. I have two kids. My oldest just turned 13. Not okay. She's amazing. She's 100% amazing. And my youngest is 9 and a half, which means they're going to be 10.
Another milestone, double digits.
They're so big. And I'm not a huge baby person, so I didn't really like, I loved my kids the whole time. I started to really enjoy them at about like 5 or 6. And so like, this is like the first time where I'm like, wait a minute, you need to slow down. You need to stop getting so big so fast. I'm married to my wife. We have been married for 18 and a half years. We met in college before we realized we were trans. So we've been through a lot together and have been really lucky in that we have grown up together and not apart. Like, we got together pretty young. Can be a little scary. Not always going to work out, but we've been really lucky and we've worked really hard to make it work.
I picked up on the emphasis there. There's like growing up together. There's like you as individuals and you as a couple as well. The shared journey part of that.
It's really cool. Yeah.
So for the mirror segment, of course, we always focus on self-awareness and self-reflection. And you had shared something pretty specific that, of course, I got really excited about anytime I hear the word gender mentioned, but especially in the context of style and or fashion. You said you wanted to talk about both of those things. So this is definitely your opportunity. What would you like to share about the intersection of gender and fashion? What does that mean to you?
Like, I was kind of a tomboy, I guess, like growing up. I'd occasionally like wear a skirt, but like, I didn't fully realize it at the time while watching The Pride and Prejudice and Colin Firth and like realizing that like those were the clothes that I wanted to wear. That was the person that I wanted to be. Like, Lizzie and Jane were fun and sophisticated, but like I wanted to be Darcy, and just like wearing like men's formal wear always felt more exciting, even though men tend to dress very boringly. I was always more excited about like suits and vests and ties and like the whole thing. And like my dad taught me to tie a tie when I was in elementary school, like 5th, 6th grade, because we were doing a school report and we were doing it in the form of Jeopardy. So I was Alex Trebek. So my dad showed me how to tie a Windsor knot, which is still like my go-to knot. He taught me how to tie a Windsor knot when I was in elementary school. And then in middle school, I was in band from 5th grade all the way through high school. In middle school, you know, there were dress codes for concerts. And for one of the middle school concerts, I talked my parents into letting me dress in the boys' dress code. And so my dad like got me a tie, and like I wore like a button down and slacks and a tie, but I had to like leave the tag on the tie because he returned it after the concert. And like I remember like walking into the room the night of the concert and just feeling like the shit, and like everybody's like, whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
It makes me think about school dress codes in general, like especially the strict ones that are like uniform based. And I always wondered about that. Like, I don't know, I love wearing pants equally as much as I love wearing dresses and skirts. And I certainly did not attend school where uniforms were required. But like, if these are the designated garments for the school, does it really matter who wears what? Like, I always wondered that. And I'm sure in conservative environments, it's like spelled out, like, first of all, there's the gender binary, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, like, girls have to wear this, boys have to wear this. But yeah, I always wondered and, like, was excited personally myself about thinking, like, what if you combined the skirt with, you know, the button-up shirt and the tie and, like, so that's very cool. I can absolutely picture you in that role as well as Alex Trebek. That's so great.
I'm pretty sure somewhere I have the tie that my dad tied for me that day.
Oh, wow.
It's really ugly, but I have it. Like, we picked his, like, ugliest tie.
I love that so much. Do you still have that same obsession with menswear? And, like, how does that play out in maybe your gender expression, but also your personal style? Like, how did that all come together in adulthood? Yeah, where are you now?
We do love menswear. My interview suit is from like the men's department, but like I also play with it, especially when I'm making my own clothes. I've been sewing since 2019, got pretty into garment sewing and really enjoyed it. And like, so like making things that fit me, but then putting the buttons on the right side instead of the left side. And like one of my favorite things is I have an A-line skirt with buttons and a matching vest, and it's blue corduroy. It's amazing with like yellow buttons. But then like looking down and seeing like my button down shirt and my vest and the skirt and all of the buttons line up, and like it's like this really like subtle detail where I'm like, oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Like, that's gender euphoria right there, is like seeing all the buttons line up. Yeah. And so, but I, you know, and like, I have the 6-button vest, but I never button the last one. Right. And like all the little like rules for it. I overdress for work every day.
I love this about you too.
I have worn a tie almost every day to work. Like, not every day, but like almost every day. But like, you know, I wear bow ties, I wear neckties, I can tie my own bow ties. And then like I'll do like the Windsor knot is sort of like my default. But today, like I did I forget what the name of it is, but it was a fancier knot. And like you take the skinnier end and you like wrap it around a bunch of times. So it creates like these layers and like overlapping layers. And it reflected the skirt, which I had made, was like, that was also like had these kind of like folds and bends, and it was really, I felt really good today.
I know you all can't see it, but if I were to describe it, like the multiple layers is fantastic. When I first saw it, it was like, it reminded me of a braid or like a fishtail, fishbone almost. Yeah. Very intricate, super like elevated. To hear you talking about overdressing for work is really cool too. Like, just for context, we're in the Pacific Northwest, and even like the hoity-toityest corporate office environment is still like jeans are acceptable, right? Like, it's understated and casual. So I just think that's so cool for you. And also your coworkers who get to bear witness to that every day.
I feel like I should get more compliments than I'm currently getting. Yeah, but like, you know, I'm trying to be humble.
They're probably just in awe, like, right? Yeah. Totally charmed and speechless.
Like, I go in there and I've got, like, you know, my matching tie and, you know, just, like, putting it all together and just, like, every morning, like, waking up. And, like, I take a lot of my fashion inspiration from nature. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be, like, I have a lot of yellow, like, dresses and skirts. So I'm like, all right, here's the sun. And then, like, green plaid and then a floral tie. And, like, really trying to, like, build up on nature and the way that those colors and patterns come together, and putting that together to use things that are traditionally kind of masculine, although on the more flamboyant end of the masculine scale.
I love that. You had mentioned in previous conversation that, like, getting dressed, even just, like, your relationship with clothing was somewhat complicated, if not, like, negative, you know, like, possibly traumatic before coming to realize your non-binary identity. Can you talk a little bit about that, like, figuring out who you are, like, the effect that that has had on how you show up?
Yeah, when, especially, like, at the job that I had back in California before COVID and when I was still, like, working in an office. And I was working for a Japanese company, and, like, so the dress code was serious. But, like, I didn't have, like, a huge wardrobe. Like, I had, you know, like, a couple of pairs of pants and, like, a couple of skirts that I wore. But, like, I was cycling through the same thing, like, every week. And, like, I was thought that, like, I was okay with that. And just, like, you know, I know who I am. I don't spend a lot of time and effort on fashion. And I saw, like, you know, like, the way that the office ladies would, like, kind of look at me. And, like, you know, the mean girls that grow up and are still mean girls.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, I don't care that I'm wearing the same clothes every week. Because you still have that little, like, the little X stitch on the back of your skirt.
Oh, gosh. To keep the vent closed.
Right? And I'm like, you don't get to throw shade at me when you still have that.
What is the phrase? Like, don't take criticism from someone you wouldn't take advice from.
Yeah.
Something
yeah, like absolutely.
That. It's like, they need to look in the mirror. Right? Speaking of mirror.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And, like, I just didn't put a lot of effort into it. Like, it didn't feel good. I had tried several times to, like, get into it and, like, have people help me go shopping and, like, figure out how to dress, but it like never stuck, and it never, like, awesome. Came out to my wife the summer of 2019, and then for our anniversary that year, we exchanged, like, dark blue button downs with little white patterns on them. She was still, like, in her gender journey as well, and so, like, figuring things out, and she didn't quite realize that she was a woman yet. And so we were both kind of, like, sharing that sort of, like, queer, like, it felt like a queer staple. Specifically, like, the dark blue with white pattern. Like, we'd seen, like, a bunch of pictures and we're like, everybody's got those. So we exchanged shirts for our anniversary that year, and I put it on and I wear it for the day and I'm feeling really good. And then it was time to take it off at the end of the day. And I started to cry because I didn't want to take it off. And I have worn a button down almost every day since. Like, and, you know, I got, to a certain extent, like, I really lucked out in, like, that my wife has always been great with colors and patterns. And as she reached the point of her own egg cracking, she had been wearing, like, a literal uniform for work, but she could dress up over, like, the uniform. So she started dressing nicer. And so she got, like, a whole bunch of more button downs and ties. And so, like, she really, like, expanded her wardrobe and then was like, I don't want to wear any of this. And I'm like, I will.
Yeah.
So I inherited a wardrobe from her that I really love. And it's kind of funny because if you see, I am 5'3.5". My wife is 6'1". But we wear the same size, more or less, because she needs, like, a bigger size to be long enough. And I need a bigger size to go around my chest. And so, like, I can wear the clothes that she bought for herself. And so I just, like, inherited an entire wardrobe. And now, and, like, you know, I've got my closet laid out in rainbow order. There's a spreadsheet with all of my shirts with all the patterns and the colors. And there's one with the ties and the colors and the, right? And it's, you know, to make sure, like, you know, okay, well, you know, I need some more purple shirts.
Yeah, you can see.
Yeah.
The gaps.
Yeah, exactly. And I do. I have so many shirts that I don't want to, like, buy more shirts, but I also want more purple shirts. Mm-hmm. So I bought some fabric recently. I'll show you later. I forgot. It's not in this room. It's, like, the purple with the little, like, eyelets.
Oh, my God. Like, cotton, like, eyelets.
Yeah. Cotton.
Oh, my gosh. That's awesome. It's like eggplant.
It's like a lavender purple. And, like, I want to make, like, you know, like, a button down. And it's
I love this. Like the color, the texture, and even like the visual elements could be considered feminine in some ways. It doesn't seem to be a masculine silhouette. And oh, I love this.
Yeah.
I can see it and I can't wait to actually see it. Like, where is this shirt? So I think this might be a good time to kind of move into the magnifying glass, which is really an extension of the same conversation, right? You mentioned fashion again, but another one of my favorite terms for, like the intersection of gender and fashion, count me in. When you add this third component, language, very curious what that brings to mind for you, like where that comes from. All three of the things in their relationship with each other individually, like whatever you want to share. The magnifying glass is really like, imagine when you're taking a magnifying glass, similar to a microscope, you're like really zeroing in on the details. So what do you think about those things?
In addition to being ADHD, I'm also dyslexic. So it took me a while to sort of come into reading. And I really love reading and I really love stories. But like in elementary school, I was in sort of like the remedial reading groups until about fifth grade. And then in sixth grade, I had a really amazing teacher. Her name was Alice Stanley. And she just saw me and was like, this kid needs to be challenged and engaged. And so, like, all of a sudden, like, I'm in the advanced reading groups, I'm in the skipping math class, like, skipping math grades to like jump ahead in math and like just like totally shifted my entire world. But being dyslexic and especially like reading out loud to my kids, it makes me very aware of language. And especially with like kids' writers, because there are some, the threshold for being a kids writer seems to be lower than it is for being like an adult writer.
As far as what, like in what way?
Like the skill, the
Okay.
language used, the just the difference between like showing versus telling. So I'm a huge fan of Dav Pilkey. By the way, I'm just going to throw this out there. Like, if you have kids, read Dav Pilkey, in particular, the Cat Kid Comic Club. He has done several series of books, and each one has gotten better than the last. Like Captain Underpants is very silly, but in an attempt to be silly, I think he kind of punches down sometimes. And then there's Dogman, but ACAB, and then there's Cat Kid Comic Club, and it is perfect. It is perfect as a kid's story, and he really knows how to write. He knows how to use language because he is also dyslexic. Like when I read his stuff out loud, it really flows, and he really balances showing and telling. And like in a graphic novel, that's surprisingly difficult to do. And my parents never talked down to us as kids, so my vocabulary has always been bigger than average. And I really like language, and I like authors who can use language, and I want to look words up. I want to learn new words. As I got older, like I really struggled as a writer through high school and even like into college. One, because I was trying to write in a style that was actually not that readable or cute. And once I learned to read what I had actually written, it improved my writing so much because then I was actually like reading what I was writing and hearing how awkwardly I was phrasing everything. And that really like opened up the idea of why grammar is the way that it is. And a lot of spelling and a lot of grammar, the rules are there to make poor people feel dumb.
There's an instant analogy and connection to fashion as soon as you said that,
Right?
right? Hierarchy and power differential and the haves and the have-nots.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, even just like down to like who gets the power punch and who has to get what's the disease that's like wasting away. One of the Bronte sisters was like, but at least I'll be fabulous.
I know what you're talking about. I can't think of it either. But there's like, there is wasting from,
Just like, men get to have a power punch and women have to starve themselves. And it's all about like power and, not wearing white after Labor Day is to make poor people feel poor.
If you're not familiar with the history, by the way, of that completely antiquated and ridiculous quote unquote rule in fashion, please do yourself a favor and look that up. What is the deal with not wearing white shoes after Labor Day? I actually wrote a blog post about that. So I was like, this is bullshit, and I want to dismantle it and figure out where it came from.
One of my favorite facts is about buttons, because, like, men's, I'm using air quotes, men's buttons are on the right side, and women's buttons, again, in air quotes, are on the left side, because when buttons were becoming a thing, men dressed themselves, and so they put the buttons in the dominant hand, so it was easy to get dressed, and women were dressed, so they gave it to the other person, because then it would be in their dominant hand. And just, like, the fact that that still is persistent just, like, completely boggles my mind. But then also, like, understanding those rules allows me to subvert them. It, like, the best writers are the ones with the big vocabularies, because then they can also, like, they can evoke the biggest feelings by using the word that not only means what they want to mean it, what they want it to mean, but also sounds right for the story.
So you mentioned this, I guess, like, duality throughout history of the bourgeoisie proletariat. You've mentioned the Bronte sisters and Pride and Prejudice at this point. I feel like we need to do, like, a period piece, like, movie marathon. Just have, like, a discussion about that. Like, the language, the power, the fashion, and, like, how all of that plays out in those stories. But I guess maybe tying back to that, like, did you pick up on that as a young reader? Like, your first experience with Pride and Prejudice, like, you knew you wanted to be Darcy. Most of your peers, I'm guessing, were salivating over him. Like, I was, like, but also I wanted the women too. And it was like, you know, do I want them or do I want to be them? Did you pick up on those themes and that nuance as you were reading that story? Like, of course, there's movies too, but, like, I don't know, was there a connection to fashion and the power dynamic or the conflict between classes?
I think it's something that I definitely have picked up more on as I've gotten older. My first exposure to Pride and Prejudice was as a high schooler in the BBC 6-hour version, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, and I didn't notice those things. I didn't consciously notice those things right away.
Today, as you're existing in the world and just, you know, moving through spaces and encountering strangers, like, people watching is what I'm thinking. Like, do you see that happening? Are those historical truths still relevant and true today?
I mean, as much as I don't want them to be, they are. You know, white rich men still have all the power. And being skinny is seen as a virtue, as long as, you know, you've got big boobs too.
There's the gender binary as well, in terms of expectations and assumptions. Like, I don't know, I think about office environments, just like we were talking about school uniforms before. Like, I certainly get the sense from you, you've mentioned it already, like, having the knowledge and the frame of reference of all the rules kind of empowers you to break them in your own way or subvert them in some ways. For you personally, is there, like, a statement there? Like, obviously it's intentional. You've shared the intentional, knowing that others are perceiving and encountering and observing you on it. Like, do you feel yourself reclaiming your power?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Or, like, middle finger up to
I am a proud dandy. Like, that's part of, like, wearing my tie every day.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, that was a toning down of the dandy accessorizing became, like, the necktie. And now it's, like, you know, I read an article about how, like, especially work from home is killing the necktie. And I'm like, no. And it's also, like, playing with that, like, in the conservative sandbox, you know, while wearing a skirt with my unshaven legs and just being like, deal with it.
Yeah. Hell yeah. I just got a flash of, like, that phrase right now in neon lights, like, deal with it. Says it all right there. Like, it's not my job or responsibility to make you comfortable.
It's also, like, really frustrating the amount of times that I just get misgendered by a stranger. I can be in, like, all clothes from the men's department, like, not even wearing a skirt. I'll be wearing, like, pants, a button down, a tie. They see my long hair. Most of the time I wear, like, mascara and eyeliner, and they're like, oh, that's a girl. And it's just, like, it is really, like, defeating. And it all, like, to a certain extent, it also feels like, well, you just don't get it. Because, like, the way that I play with my gender sometimes is really subtle. Because I'm not one of those non-binary folks that's wearing, like, brown paper bags, right? Or, like, really oversized clothes to, like, just sort of, like, blend into. Right? Like, I am a dandy. I am going to dress up. And sometimes that means skirts and sometimes that means pants, but like I am almost always wearing a button down and a tie, like, and still just like people, they see my long hair and then they're done.
I hate that that happens so often. I'm sorry about that. And also thank you for sharing. That's tough. I think about, like, I guess futurism is probably not the right word, but, like, a lot of these conversations, certainly our connection, I feel like many of us are a little further ahead than the general population. Like, we're just waiting for them to get their act together and catch up. And it might be decades. We may not witness it in our lifetime. You're a leader, whether you know it or not.
Attention Confidential is sponsored, produced, and distributed by Self Magnitude LLC, an ethical microbusiness on a mission to transform how you see yourself. It is hosted by Maggie Green, personal brand and style strategist for weirdos and queerdos of all ages and gender expressions, who is also the face and voice behind Self Magnitude, helping people feel seen since 2020. If you're looking for support on embodying all aspects of your identity and showing up as your radically authentic self in person, in print, and online, please visit Maggie's 100% DIY website at selfmagnitude.com.
Something that's come up in both the segments that we talked about so far, the mirror and the magnifying glass, is the reference to school. You mentioned that you're a parent as well. I think kind of keeping those in mind be a nice segue into our final segment, the megaphone, which is all about amplifying a mission or message that you feel really passionate about and connected to. And when I asked you about your megaphone, you mentioned PTA, PTOs. You want to tell us a little bit more about that?
I got involved in my elementary school PTA because someone else, my youngest bestie's mom, is big in the PTA. She really loves to like organize events and started going to PTA events like as soon as her kid was in kindergarten. She was running for the board and she knew that I had a background in accounting. And for some reason, treasurer positions are really hard to fill. I don't know if it's like why people are so intimidated by money and numbers and accounting spreadsheets. Like, give them to me all day long, but it's a really hard position to fill. And so she asked me if I would come. She was going to be president, co-president, but she didn't want to do it unless the team was good. And she knew that with my background, she asked me to come and be treasurer. It was easily one of the best things that has ever happened to me. In actuality, like I know PTAs and PTAs have kind of a reputation of being sort of bitchy, judgmental mothers, but it has been the first time where I felt accepted and valued and appreciated in a community. And so I'm the treasurer at the elementary school and in the middle school because my kids are in two different schools now. And the appreciation that it has given me for public school teachers and the amount of effort that they are putting in and the number of things that they are being asked to do and the amount of money that they are spending to make their classrooms functional out of their own pocket. And especially with this administration and their assault on public education, your PTA is doing a lot of work and it's probably 10 people doing a lot of work and they could really use your help. Like even if you're not like a parent, but just like an adult in the community, like reach out to those PTAs if you've got the capacity to do so. We don't need, you know, a bunch of chefs in the kitchen, but we do need help like running, putting events on, because it takes a lot of people
and bodies, right?
And just like, even just like set up and clean up, like getting bodies in there to help move heavy things is just, it would be so amazing. And like, even if you don't have kids, having that impact to help the kids in your community have a good experience, I think is really important. And it's not just important for parents. And like, I want to be perfectly clear. I do not think having kids is for everyone, but I do think that kids are a part of our community. And having a healthy generation come up is really important to everybody who is currently around. You know, like, these are going to be our doctors, among other things. And just that community, local community, is really the foundation, and it what makes me feel personally safe. Like, my family is very trans. We're very queer. All of us identify under the queer umbrella. Feel safe, like, in my community. They accept me for who I am. And like, that community is really important, because like, I get to raise my kids in a community where they don't feel alone.
I mean, I don't have children. I've been out of the public school system for a very long time, but it occurs to me, like, I don't know if that would be common knowledge, like, if it would occur to a member of the community who is not a parent to contribute in that way. But
I mean, it's really helpful. But also, like, if you don't have time, but you do have money, money is also really helpful. One of the biggest things that we do in both the PTAs is reimburse teachers for classroom expenses that are coming out of their pockets. And it's not a huge amount that we're able to do, but it's better than nothing. And also, like, we have a big carnival at the end of the year, and there's a silent auction, and we go around to different businesses soliciting donations to auction off. Like, there is some way for you to contribute to your local schools, and that doesn't even have to be being around kids.
Yeah. I feel like that's really important. You know, the fact that there are other ways to get involved, other ways to contribute. It doesn't have to be like a formal leadership role. It doesn't even have to be like necessarily a set schedule or a regular volunteer, you know, effort thing that you have, whatever resources you have to dedicate. And it's not just about investing in your own children. If you don't have children, it's about your community. It's about the future, the next generation. That's really powerful and important. Thank you. It's awesome. That is awesome. As far as like actionable kind of insights, you know, to close out, find out who your PTA is, who your PTO is, reach out to them, ask them how you can help, right?
Yeah.
What other things? Is there anything else, especially given where we are right now? I don't even have to say it. Like, we're all living in this moment, in this climate. What do you feel like is really important? Is there a message or something on your heart that you wish you could like scream from the rooftops that everyone needs to hear right now?
I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it gets better. And it gets better because you understand yourself more. And being visible in your community, especially if you are a minority in any way, gives those kids an opportunity to see that it's possible. And like, if you are a queer adult who does not want to have your own kids because of like the trauma that you went through, like, that's 100% valid. And you can still be, there's still ways for you to be visible enough that who you were can see that it's possible to keep going, that it will get better, and you will have more control over your own life. Because kids, they have so little power and they have so little control. And like, hope is sometimes the only thing they have. And you can give that to them.
Yeah, it makes me think of that as you were sharing earlier too. Like, your involvement helps your kids not feel alone by itself. Like, knowing that you're not alone. You know, how alone and isolated and left out and other did you feel growing up in school? Like, I won't say it's a universal human experience, but gosh, how many of us felt that?
Friends that want to see me. They check on me when I'm feeling crappy or quiet. They like spending time with me. They appreciate what I add to this, to any given encounter.
Everyone should have that. I'm glad that you do. I feel part of a community with you. Like, we, you know, you're people, And that gives me hope, too. This conversation, the vulnerability that you're willing to share means a lot. I think it will resonate with others as well. Thank you for being here. Thank you for being you, for sharing your stories today. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in.
That's all for this episode of Attention Confidential, but of course, the conversation doesn't end here. I encourage you to keep exploring, keep questioning, and most of all, keep sharing your stories. If today's conversation spoke to you, please pass it on. And if you have a story of your own you'd like to showcase, I am here and ready to listen. You can find all past and future episodes at selfmagnitude.com/podcast. And until next time, remember this. Your voice matters.